I think I was trying to think of. I think it was one of the very first synthesized complete 2-meter rigs, KDK. And I heard tell somebody sold one of those, or almost sold one of those today at the flea market. In fact, there was a major flea market today at Limark, at, I think it was Levittown Hall. I didn't get a chance to go. If anyone with the sound of my voice was at that flea market, give us a little bit of a description of what you saw and what was the best deal. Anybody within the sound of my voice want to tell us what the flea market was like today? Give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Tim, N2RDB.
Tim, N2RDB. Anyone else?
Yeah, Dick. WB2HWW. 200 people.
Okay. That's Howie's report. And Tim, take your time. What did you see? How many vendors? What did you buy? And describe the good one that got away. Over to you, Tim. My name is Dick.
Hi, thank you kindly. This is Tim, N2RDB. Well, first of all, we got there a little bit early. The vendors are still setting up, and there were quite a few vendors there. There were some people that did not make it, and it would be easier to tell you who didn't make it than who did. There's one fellow from Caldwell, New Jersey, Gene, I forget his call sign. He was not there. He's usually there. And the fellow who does the embroidered hats and the T-shirts and jackets and whatnot that sets up in the lobby, he was not there. Most of the other regulars were there. And you could have everything from old used commercial radios to brand new FT-2000 Yaesu units to HT, everything, everything. I myself bought a base antenna for 6 meters, 2 meters, and 440. It's one of those fiberglass jobbies. It's about 8 feet tall. I bought a triplexer for the same bands. I bought a little flexible antenna for my for one of my HTs, a couple of miscellaneous fittings, an old phone linesman's test handset, and a couple other little odds and ends. But the place was jam-packed. I mean, you were literally colliding with people in the aisles. People were standing elbow to elbow to try to get a look at the tables. The place, it was an awesome ham fest. The place was totally packed. The problem is it got so hot in there from the body heat, they had to crack a few windows, and I guess with a couple of hundred people, primarily men, you you get some interesting aromas in the place without going into details. But they finally did open some windows and some fresh air came in. And when we left at about 11:30 or 11:45, a couple of vendors had sold most of their stuff and were starting to pack it in. Most of them were there for the long haul, though. N2RDB.
Now, let me tell you about my big purchase, Dick.
Tell us about your big purchase, Howie. And give a little bit of a delay.
It was so big it cost me $5. I bought a 3-foot jumper cable. Somebody had RG-142 double shielded. It had two end connectors. I can always use an extra piece of collapse. I mainly went to say hello to friends. So this guy had a bunch of, you know, jumper cable. I said, yeah, I can use it. You never know when you need it for a duplex or something. It was 3 feet long.
Sounds like fun. Tim, the fact that the place was that packed, that's a little bit encouraging. I mean, would you stretch your imagination a little bit and say that maybe it's an indication that the economy is recovering a little bit, that hams are willing to go to a flea market and buy things, or at least seriously consider buying things, because there was that many of them there. I'm pretty sure Andy was set up on the stage doing his tune-up clinic of rigs. And from what you're saying, the majority of the vendors that you normally see sound like they were there. Just a couple of them didn't make it. I did hear a couple of people discussing on the repeater at around midday today of all the things they sold. It sounds like the people who were selling things, a number of them went there and sold 85% of everything they brought. Kind of curious, Tim, that when your vehicle went back to Mineola, was it a little bit heavier than when it went to the Levittown Hall? Back to you, Tim.
Well, slightly heavier. I basically got everything I personally went there to get. Hey, I was stimulating the economy, you know? But seriously, from the site I saw at that ham fest, and yes, Andy was up at the front, and he was basically up to his ears and, you know, people who were asking him questions, including myself about this particular antenna that I bought. I obviously got a fairly favorable report. Yeah, Andy had his hands full. And my friend Steve, KB2MJC, well, he always has people, like, giving him stuff when they leave, you know, stuff they didn't sell or whatever, but he sold a bunch of stuff, too. And from the turnout at this particular Hamfest, you wouldn't know that there was a recession to begin with. And to RDB.
That's probably a good sign. I know that some of the people who go to Dayton have been saying that the attendance was down slightly over the last few years. Maybe we're beginning to recover. The Dow Jones and other things do seem to be showing some recovery. The number of unemployed people is certainly lagging. It's got a long way to go there. And I received a... Oh, yeah, I meant to mention to you guys, I received a phone call from a man who is in the right place at the right time in some point of view. One of the ways of recovering the economy is that this is a real good time that Mr. Obama could be doing a lot more renewable energy resources, trying to make us a little bit more independent of all of this foreign oil. That does create a certain amount of grief and a certain amount of disturbance to our economy. So the man lives in Ohio, and he has a proposed wind farm that's going to be installed roughly 1,000 feet from his house. It's the beginning of the wind farm. And the wind farm is going to consist of a significant number of these turbines where the blades, either a two- or three-bladed turbine, the top of the blade will be 490 feet above the ground, and there's a whole lot of them, and they begin 1,000 feet away from his property if he doesn't protest and win and force them to give a little bit more setback. His question to me, let me drop.
That's probably a good sign. I know that.
Oh. His question to me was what will happen to radio propagation in the vicinity of all these moving turbines, of these moving blades. And I think the blades are primarily made out of fiberglass. And if you look at the blade in cross-section, I'm guessing the blade sweeps out a circle, and only 5 or 10% of that circle is the actual blade. The rest of it is the air in between. So I think the changes of radio propagation, because he runs a repeater that's going to be 1,000 feet away from this wind farm, he wants to know, is his repeater going to be wiped off the air? And I think the answer is no. My prediction to him was that if he was standing with a handy talkie in front of that wind farm, and at the far side of the wind farm, let me pick a number, 25 miles away, is a repeater he's communicating with, therefore he's very close to these blades, and the signal to him is kind of weak, just a little bit above threshold, slightly noisy signal. In that worst-case situation, as those blades spin and the reflection of the blades is sometimes in phase and sometimes out of phase, I think he's going to hear some picket fencing on a weak signal. But my rough guess is the amount of picket fencing is really going to be the signal jumping up and down in amplitude in a sine wave manner, going up and down in amplitude a couple of dB. So that if on an FM handy-talkie with its capture effect of its limiter assembly. If the signal started off 10 dB above threshold, I think he would not know the blades are there. That's my gut feel. But I haven't actually done it. And my suggestion to him was he get a hold of a particular guy I know who is one of the spark plugs of the San Bernardino Microwave Society in San Bernardino, California, roughly. This particular guy lives in right outside of China Lake Naval Testing Station. But in that vicinity, in the Mojave Desert, they have a very large wind farm called the Tehachapi Wind Farm. When I was doing work out there at Edwards Air Force Base in China Lake, I remember passing by the Tehachapi Wind Farm. It looked to me like 500 acres of these great big wind turbines. And so by talking to the people who lived in that area, who have now accumulated history, they'll find out what is the radio propagation like in the vicinity of a wind farm. But I did tell this man that I would promise him that I would ask if anyone on this repeater has any information about what kind of radio detriment, grief, flutter, QSB, picket fencing, or whatever, has anyone ever experienced by living near or operating near a wind farm? Because if this turns out not to be anywhere near as bad a thing as some people are worrying about, it might be a straw man, so to speak, in which case the more renewable energy we got, the sooner we'll be away from the dependence on foreign oil. Let me drop.
More comment, Ham Fair.
Okay, go back to the Ham Fair comment in a minute. But let me finish this thought. So if anybody's got any specific information, I want to know about it. So let's go over to Tim and about the Ham Fair, and then we'll go back and see if anybody knows anything about wind farm detriment to RF propagation. Over to you, Tim. K2RIW and 2RDB.
I almost forgot to tell you the most important part. There was a VE session today, and five new hams joined our ranks, and from what I heard, there were four or five upgrades as well. So, way to go, new people and upgrades. And as far as renewable energy, we're always going to need some oil for, petroleum, for plastic and whatnot. But to stimulate the economy, all ham radio equipment, due to the fact that it's emergency-related equipment, should be tax-deductible. That's my idea. And for those who aren't hams, they should drink heavily and recycle their aluminum cans. I call it my 401 keg plan. Back to Net, N2RDB.
Not bad, Tim. And do you know that one of those five brand new hams that became licensed today was 9 years of age? Back to you, Tim.
Hey, I just love it when the kids join in. That's what we need, new blood in the hobby. I love it. You know, that's really encouraging news. Hey, maybe he can get some of his buddies to come down and take the test the next time. N2RDB.
Yeah, we certainly do need some new blood. Because an awful lot of the hams are kind of long in the tooth and white in the hair. Because the modern-day kids are much more enthusiastic about computers and text messaging and these little boxes that they carry with them that are either gaming or messaging or communicating or whatever. They're involved in RF, but not quite the way we are. But these wind farms, I know that a pessimist will say all the renewable energy resources, wind, tide, solar, geothermal, I'm trying to think of something, photovoltaic, photothermal, all of these things are not going to replace oil. And there's a degree of truth in that. However, the longest journey begins with the first step. You got to start somewhere. For us to be importing 20 or 21 million barrels per day of foreign oil, sending tremendous amounts of dollars overseas and handing it to people who don't like us so much. There's got to be a better way. We're spilling an awful lot of our American blood defending those sources of that oil, defending the countries that, if everything goes well, they can continue to supply us oil. We've got to become more energy independent. Wind is one of the ways of doing it. And so anybody who has any information on radio flutter, radio characteristics, or whatever, of operating near or living near a wind farm, particularly a really big one like the ones they're building in the Midwest, in this Ohio area, I'd like to know about that. Send an email to me or to Mel on anything you know about wind farms and whether or not it did make a change in television reception, radio reception, repeater operation, anything to do with wireless. It is my gut feel that the detriment is going to be minor. But I'm not positive. I haven't actually lived near next to one. And this buddy of mine who called me up is living next to one, and he's worried. He wants to know how hard he should fight. He's coming up to a deadline where a decision's going to be made as to should they put it in the proposed location or should they set it back a little bit further away from his property. Anybody know anything? Give me a call, let us right now. And if the answer is no answer, nobody's got any information at all. If you find some information later, please mail me an email on the subject, me email or whoever. My call letters at arrl.net. It's an easy one to remember. If there's no answer, then we'll go back to reading the mail. Anybody got any answer on wind farms? Give me a call letters and name right now. KQRIW. Yeah, because they're not really popular in the New York metro area, I was a little bit afraid that we right here might not have any information. But by way of IRLP and other people who listen to this net, somewhere across the United States, Canada, or whatever, there's going to be somebody who's got some specific information about radio effects of a wind farm. So back to you and your mailbag, Mel. That's a tongue twister. KQKEY with that great big sack of mail. KQRIW.
This is K2KEY. All right, let me just finish off the one with the Gonset. Answer his question. That Gonset, unbalanced strip line, what burnt out in there is the strip line, which I say, if I remember correctly, for 2 meters, that strip line was like 9 inches long, a piece of copper foil, and maybe about a, I don't know, maybe a half inch or so wide or something like that. Would I be about correct for 2 meters thick for a tuner? Over.
Okay. If the person knows the frequency is 2 meters, and if he knows the materials he intends to use to construct the strip line that does the replacement, there are quite a number of websites he can go to by just Googling the word strip line and strip line design, where if he knows the air spacing, so to speak, and the width of the line, it'll tell him what is the so-called Z0 characteristic impedance. Your next question is, what's the magic characteristic impedance? 50 ohms is a good guess. Maybe it isn't. But after you make one out of a copper strip that's something more substantial with an air spacing instead of built into a printed circuit board that burns up, I mean, when you replace something, you'd like to make it more sturdy the next time around. And maybe by mistake that thing was going into an antenna that was a short circuit. It was set in such a way that the strip line ran hot and somebody ran the transmitter key down for 5 solid minutes and burned it up. I mean, there's a comedy of errors like that are probably required to create the damage you're describing. But to redesign it, to make it better, and to figure out what's the Z0 of that line and what's the length, there isn't too much magic there. 50 ohms is a good beginning, and try it, you'll like it. There are paper designs for a tuner. Quite possibly it is a Pi tuner in schematic diagram, where the piece of strip line was the VHF equivalent of the coil of a Pi network. A certain length of transmission line does act like an inductor. And so maybe that's what it was. So I know that's not a whole answer. I'd like to believe there's another website he could go to that'll give him a service manual for that particular piece of equipment. I'm a little worried that it's a darn old, but then again, old could be good. There are people out there who just love collecting antique equipment, and they have collections of manuals on the websites that sometimes can be had for a very inexpensive price, sometimes for free. The VHF operators are the more pure, VHF, UHF operators are the more pure people. They're not into it for the money. And if you find the right website, you may be able to find the manual. That'll show you a picture of the old one, and that'll make it even easier to do the replacement. They've just made a guess. You know where the burnt-up strip line started. You know where it stops. It tells you its length. You don't know its width and its spacing. You don't know it's Z0, but starting off at 50 ohms is not bad. Nobody builds strip line beyond 100 ohms. Very few people build strip line less. I goofed. I left my transmitter set in the wrong mode. I overheated it, and it's in the self-protect mode right now. So I'm on a handy talky right now, and it looks like it's working for the time being. I was starting to say, nobody builds strip line at a higher impedance than 100 ohms. Nobody, rarely does anybody build strip line at less than 5 or 10 ohms. Midway between those two is around 50 ohms. So 50 ohms is a very good guess as to the impedance that was used. Hopefully my rig will cool itself off and come back to normal, and I'll be back on a better sounding transmitter. Over to you, Mel. So these are some of the guesses as to how to repair that rig. K2KEY, K2RIW on a handy talkie.
Good copy on a handy talkie. Sounds great, Dick. Almost didn't know that you switched transmitters. Yeah, very good. Yeah, well, I'm picturing the Gonset. This is a Gonset, was made for the Gonset Communicated, and they were about 12 watts, I believe. The final tube they had in there, now I remember, was a 2E26, World War II tube that was developed for, at that time, for use on 100-plus megahertz, and they employed it in the Gonset Communicator. And then they had this tuner for it, so if I remember correctly, it was a copper strip in there, and it ran about around, if you measured, you can see, you know, the length. It went between, the copper strip actually went between the two connectors there, it was 50 ohms to 50 ohms, by the way, and two small variable capacitors in there. So, to find the schematics and things like that for that, good luck. That, I think, you may have a real uphill battle. Okay, let's see, getting late. Okay, I want to talk to you about one more thing, and so we'll let the strip line tuner go for now. Unless somebody else wants to make any comments on it, over. All right, you sent me some very information that is really, should I say, cutting edge, exciting, new, something that we have never delved into, and that's this Landstorfer antennas, and that we thought basically was just a lot of theory lay a couple of years ago, but is really being put into some practical use. So what do you think you found? What did you get out of the article, Dick, that you sent me? And I think I'll give you what I think. But what do you think about that idea that they put six on a plate on that disc, over?
Yeah, what Mel is describing, and sorry that my voice is a darn mushy on this handy talkie before my rig cools off and comes back to normal. What Mel is describing is a... article that's in the, I think it's the October issue of Antennas and Propagation Journal. Yes, the Antennas and Propagation Society Journal of the IEEE. And this Lansdorfer antenna is built as a three-element Yagi. And what makes it look different than an ordinary Yagi is that each element is in this crazy U-shape or a Gaussian shape. Each element of the Yagi is not a half wavelength long, but three half wavelengths long. And a certain gain advantage and performance advantage when you do that. And they didn't set up just one of these antennas on a strip line. This is a 900 megacycle or 1,000 megacycle antenna. They set up six of them in a hexagonal pattern. So depending on which one you connect the transmitter to, you're transmitting in one of six directions. They're all separated by, I guess, let's see, six into 360. I should know how many degrees apart they are. Is it 60 degrees? I think it is. They're all 60 degrees apart. So you can choose the direction of transmission and the direction of reception on this hexagonal piece of printed circuit board. I'm not sure of its exact size, but it looks to me like it's about an 8-inch in diameter. I don't have the article in front of me right now. And depending on which one you feed, that is the direction you're transmitting and receiving from. Kind of an exciting-looking antenna. It looks like a very nice development to me. The combination of Lansdorf and directional array printed circuit. I'd like to believe that Kent, WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor, Juliet, Bravo. You go to thosecallletters.com, and you'll see a very nice website of printed circuit UHF antennas that you can buy. Very inexpensive, high-performance UHF antennas. I'd like to believe that Kent will eventually come out with a version of that and add it to his list of about 10 or 15 products that he's already got. That's my first impression, Mel. And you can tell why I had to work pretty hard to get you that article, and I thought it was worth the effort. K2KEY, what did you think of it? K2LIW.
The one they put together that six on that piece of board, on PC board, was at 2.5 gigs they were operating it at, and they were using these pin diodes to switch it, that they could, in other words, instead of rotating this antenna, they are switching it, as you said, six of them, 60 degrees spacing around the board. So it's, you know, something that I guess that really surprised me, that from the, you know, the initial experiment that was very, very positive. I believe they did it in, what was it, at MIT, or was it one place, I think out in California, I think it was MIT, not MIT, California Institute of Technology, CIT, Dick Dover.
Yes, I agree with you. I think it was California Institute of Technology. But it looks like an awful nice design. And I'll bet you a number of the people who listen to us, once they find that article, and by the way, if you're already an IEEE member, and if you're a member of the AAP Society, you have free access to that online through the IEEE. The only other people who will have free access to the article is to be a member of this... Why can't I think of the name of it now? Explore. If you buy the Explore function, which costs some money. If you go to a good technical library that gets Antennas and Propagation Journal of the IEEE, you look at the latest issue, you'll find that article. So it's eventually going to appear in ham journals, I guarantee it. And I think there's a good chance that Kent is eventually going to be making a version of that available. That's my guess. He hasn't said so yet. I haven't discussed that with him yet. I don't think he's even seen the article yet. Kent was very busy this weekend with the Microwave Update conference that took place in Dallas, Texas. And so those guys were heavy into microwave from Wednesday night until Sunday afternoon. And I've been to some of those Microwave Updates. I mean, these guys almost go around the clock telling each other war stories of what they've been doing with microwave ham radio. And so these guys come away from that conference, and it takes them a couple of days to recover. They sometimes they recover at their place of business, if you know what I mean. So, back to you, Mel, for any other comments. K2LIW with K2KEY.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I would assume we're going to see Landsoffer type of antenna design. Gradually, right now, of course, the original concept, in fact, when I first saw the article, when I brought it up a few weeks back, you know, I didn't, you know, we were just talking about it, and, you know, I didn't expect it to all of a sudden to show up at an IEEE bulletin, because the other article was somewhere else. I don't remember where I saw it, some other antenna review. It was a review that happened to be brought up because of the situation that developed with that DX expedition, that 3Y0 DX expedition to Peter 1 Island, and what happened when the wind bent their vertical into sort of a question mark. I saw the picture of it. It looked like the vertical became like a big question mark, and it was responded to that basically there wasn't definitely that the improvement in the signal was expected, because Landsoffer basically said that doing this to the vertical will improve its performance. And I am now questioning, do you think that if I should try an experiment, I don't think the weather will be too much, you know, cooperative much longer, be interesting to try an experiment, say at 10 megahertz, 30 meters, in bending up maybe an antenna in the Landsoffer type of design, over.
I'm down to my last two rigs, Kenwood 711. I like them so much, I'm slowly putting the other one online. Foolish me not to have it online. Yeah, that's definitely worth considering, Mel. What frequency, once again, would you like to use it on? A lower frequency? Would you like to build one in free space, if I understand correctly, to be electronically tuning? Or why not just build it as a high-performance Yagi on whatever band and mechanically rotate it in the old-fashioned way? Because I didn't hear everything you said because I'm trying to switch over this rig. You may have to repeat some of that, Mel. Back to you, K2LIW.
WHYY.
Hold on one, everybody. Let's Dick switch radios, and then we'll pick it up from there. What would I like? Well, building a Yagi. Okay, well, first let me see if Dick is back before we get into the discussion, and then we'll pick up URYY also. Hold on one, everybody. Let's come back on frequency.
Yeah, I think I'm back. Back on the regular rig. Joe, what did you want to ask us or say?
You keep on knocking my nose off the reflector because you're timing out the reflector. But it has more than 4 minutes of continuous transmission and knocks everybody off the reflector. Your repeater out east automatically connects to the reflector, but my stuff doesn't. So occasionally I'm losing you because you're not leaving gaps between the transmissions.
Yeah, we did. And tonight I know we did a lot more gapping, but still not enough is what I think you're saying. Okay, point well taken. Mel, you were about to tell me your latest way of using Landsoffer. How do you think you're going to use it? I know you already said it, but you're going to have to repeat it to me because I wasn't paying attention. Sorry.
Well, I guess we have to pause a little longer. What I was thinking of, building a Yagi for HF, even for 10 meters and all, would be quite an undertaking to get that bell shape, that proper bell shape. I don't know if I actually could understand the mathematics yet completely about how to get this correct bell shape. You notice it is a kind of unusual shape. I guess they call it a bell shape, but I don't know if that is really a good description of that antenna's element shape. So building a Yagi like that and getting those, to be able to bend, you know, tubing and get it precise enough to really see, you know, give it a really a good chance, I think would be a little bit of a project, Dick, over.
Good guess, Mel, but I don't think so. I don't think it's that precise and that persnickety. That's the best way I can explain it. If I took a half-wave dipole and set it in the center, we all know what the pattern's going to look like. It's a kind of a figure-eight pattern, a very flattish figure-eight. And let me let the machine drop a little longer. The machine has to, the half-wave dipole, we know what the pattern would look like. A full-wave dipole tends to have a null that's broadside. Or is it one and a half waves? I think it's a full-wave dipole. Has a null that's broadside, depending on how you feed it. If you can feed the center portion of a full-wave dipole with a signal that's out of phase, like with a hairpin feeding arrangement, that forces everything to be back in phase again. So the middle of the bell-shaped curve of Lansdorfer really is a kind of a quarter-wave long stub, a half-wave dipole folded back onto itself so that it looks like twin lead almost, is a quarter-wave stub. And there's nothing magic about making it exactly parallel the stub, the twin lead stub in the middle. You can give it a curve and get a little bit of extra spacing, a little bit of extra gain out of it. In my opinion, that bell-shaped curve, Mel, is quite forgiving. If I made three different bell-shaped curves, one a little bit wide, one a little bit narrow, and I readjust the length of the total structure so that it hits resonance, I'll come back very close to the same performance. So I think you've got a lot of forgiveness in the way you build that bell-shaped curve. Until you sort of see the way it works, at first you think everything's got to be done to the nearest millimeter when you're building it at 10 meters. I don't think it's anywhere near that persnickety. If you were building a 6-meter version of that, I'll bet you could make errors in that bell-shaped curve that are 6 inches wrong in position of portions of the bell, and I don't think it would make any difference at all. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I'm really not that familiar with. I think we'd have to delve more into, you know, what actually he found in his experiment. Does he have a mathematical formula for determining shape and all? Where does the point of there is a critical point? Where does it show up? Now, if what fascinates me is when they used the vertical, they took according to what they said, you know, with the DX expedition, it was a standard vertical. I believe it was, whose vertical was it that they were using? I think it was High Gain or Krushcraft. I'm not sure which one. And the vertical was just standing there, and when it was bent into this so-called big question mark shape, that it improved its performance. Now, the vertical wasn't changed in any way in length, Dick. Sort of contradicts Lansdorfer, over.
Yes, that one does, and it's a little bit hard to explain. But when it comes to the shape of the Lansdorfer you and I would make, if I simply took a Xerox copy of that article and expanded it, blew it up into the wavelength that I care about, that would be close enough. If you have any doubt, build one on your favorite frequency, 432, 902, 1296, 2304. Build a scare model out of wire and printed circuit board, or laying down tape on a piece of printed circuit board material. Build an experimental model. We all have, by now, established a lot of faith in our ability to scale things. So build a higher frequency model, confirm that it's got the performance you like, then duplicate it with the exact same shape down at your lower frequency by just multiplying all the dimensions. So when we have some doubt as to whether or not we can duplicate that bell-shaped curve with enough accuracy, and I think it's a very forgiving curve, a simple model at a higher frequency will reveal that to us very, very fast, Mel. But I think I understand how it works, and I think the beginning of the article does relate it to a stub-fed pair of half-wave dipoles that are collinear, which is very similar to what you and I would call a hairpin feeding system of the driven element of a Yagi. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW. Wait for the beep.
Give it a chance here. You know, that's the best way to go, Vic. Before I jump into building, you know, big antennas, of course, which is going to be necessary for the size to cover something like anywhere in the lower HF band. The idea would be, I think, maybe 2 meters would be ideal, or 70 centimeters would be an ideal place to, you know, experiment, because this is, as you said, you know, capable of working on your workbench, doing, you know, work at those frequencies. But what would be nice, I think, why I say 2 meters or 70 centimeters, I can easily then find people on the air to do actual AB measurements with. In other words, finding people up at 900 or something may be a little hard, you know, to find any activity that will, with people that are, you know, consistent. I could no doubt easily get people here to go simplex, or just, you know, get an idea of what the difference is, say, between a number of simple design 2 meter antennas or 70 centimeter antennas, and then switch over to a Landsoffer. In fact, you could do it basically with the antenna, as you say, laid out on a bench. Over.
Can you imagine, Mel, what would happen if you connected a cord to the middle of your green piece of wire that's on that evergreen tree out in front of your house, add some extra green wire at the bottom, and pull it into that bell-shaped curve? And now you'd have a vertically polarized Landsoffer with some extra length of wire. You have the resources to do that. I have the resources to do that. I've got a piece of rope going up to the top of my tower right now with a pulley. And when I get out from under a couple of my obligations, I'd love to set up a pure vertical HF dipole. I'm not much of an HF operator, but just to see what can be done, I'd love to run a pure vertical half-wave dipole up one of my towers and see what happens. Feed it at the bottom, tilt it at various angles out from the tower so it's kind of a sloper. Some of the experiments like you've done, I am looking forward to doing that sometime in the future. I'm going to have to eat lots of vegetables and fruit and take my vitamins, stay healthy so I get a chance to do that. Thank you, Mel. K2RIW.
Hope I gave enough pause. Oh, I'd love to hear your results with a dipole that you basically can do more than I can. You've got a little bit more height there, and you also got a little bit maybe more room to work with. And it'd be interesting, like I've done my experiment mostly at 10 megahertz, which makes it a little bit more reasonable for length sizes and, you know, heights. But what would happen if you duplicate that experiment on, say, 80 meters? Be interested to see what will happen if, for instance, you put yourself a vertical dipole on 80 meters and then adjusted the angles like I did with some kind of cantilever roping or whatever you want to do it, however you come up with the idea of being able to pull the bottom out and all. Be very interested to see what happens in the case of just the effect, because it would answer a lot of questions. There's still a lot of questions that, you know, I'm not sure of answers as to what really takes place. What actually is happening when you start to, what I would think would be, you know, I would always be very doubtful if somebody would told me that if you are taking a vertical dipole and making it more into a concave type of design, that not a sloper, see? They would think of it as basically, oh, you're pulling it as a sloper. No. I'm saying pulling it out, you know, gradually curving it more or less. Am I approaching a Landsoffer design in that way, Dick? Over.
I don't think so, because in order to get extra gain, you cannot get extra gain out of an antenna And let me bypass HF for a minute. In the case of HF, what your local ground is doing and the way you're launching currents into your counterpoise, there's a lot of complicating factors that are sort of away from the antenna. We're starting to get into the local environment effects. But if I get away from local environment effects of some HF layouts, and I really talk about antennas in free space, you cannot get extra gain out of an antenna without having directivity. That means an antenna pattern. You can't get an antenna pattern until you start using up real estate. You got to have some real volume. In other words, from the tip of the antenna on the left side to the tip of the antenna on the right side, it's got to be some good fraction of a wavelength or some number of wavelengths in order for you to have the wherewithal by which you stand the chance of creating a more directive pattern. That's it. The antenna's got to be longer. A rhombic has got gain because it's longer. A Yagi antenna has got gain because by way of the boom in that dimension, it's longer. And Lansdorfer is making a dipole that's not a half wave long, but electronically, it's three half wavelengths long. It's using more real estate. Once you accept that concept, it takes real estate for a free space antenna to have the pattern, to have more gain. Lansdorfer, let me drop. Lansdorfer is doing that by setting up these three half-wave dipoles in a quasi-collinear manner. But he has curved, he has bent up the middle half-wave dipole so much that it really is a kind of a flattened hairpin feeding arrangement. It's almost a quarter-wave open-wire stub. But he didn't make it look like a pure open-wire stub. He gave it this exotic curve. The exotic curve, I think, is a second-order effect. It's just a particular way of getting a tapered impedance. There's nothing wrong with the quarter-wave length-long stub being non-constant 200 ohms or non-constant 300 ohms. There's nothing saying you've got to be constant in impedance. There's certain advantages of making the hairpin variable. The hairpin in the middle, or the quarter-wave stub, is variable in its impedance. It's got higher impedance at the non-shorted end because it flares out and becomes the rest of the other two halves of the dipole. That's what I think is going on there, Mel. It is a tapered impedance quarter-wave stub in the middle of a pair of quasi-collinear pair of half-wave dipoles. That's what I think it is. And when you build not only the driven element that way, but the director in front and the reflector in back in the exact same method of construction, he's using more real estate, he's getting more directivity, he's got more gain. But he didn't have to pay the price by building a whole bunch of antennas side by side with a power divider and a phasing harness. It's all built into the structure. That's my first cut of what I think is going on. K2KEY, K2LIW. Wait for the beep.
I'm completely confused, Dick, because I understand what you're saying. Yes, more real estate, more material up there, and that counts for basically, let's just say that, more capture area or whatever. But how do we account for, if it's been was well documented over periods of weeks, that the vertical antenna, as it was, because it got bent into the shape of a big question mark, what actually was happening? What took place with this vertical? It's just a pattern change that, well, if it was just a pattern change, would it be everybody in the world hearing that improvement because the antenna got bent into a certain shape that improved its pattern? Is that what we're looking at? Or what exactly are we, what exactly do you think took place at this point? Over.
Yeah, I think I think you're discussing that de-expedition where the antenna got bent and a great big improvement took place. To me, that is a mystery, Mel. I don't have a good explanation for that one. assuming he had a very high performance vertical antenna to begin with. And now he bent it in some exotic way where he did not use more real estate. Yet he got a, from his point of view, well documented over a couple of weeks, tremendous increase in performance. Without using more real estate to get more directivity, that is a mystery. How good was his counterpoise before and after, and what changes to it? I mean, the local ground effects probably are a factor. We're sitting here assuming that his antenna to begin with had high performance, and the way he was feeding it had high performance, and the transmitter was really putting out full power. After that storm, if the performance of the antenna wasn't good to begin with, and now it became good, that'll make an improvement. If the transmitter in the beginning, before the storm, wasn't putting out good power, but putting out better power afterwards, there's a number of variables that could have taken place. So I think we've got more unknowns than knowns in that de-expedition mill. That's a hard one to explain. But without using more real estate, it's very hard to explain extra gain. If anything, after he took a fixed length antenna, didn't add more to it, bent it up so that it became smaller, it's hard to believe that he got more gain out of using less real estate. You can see some of the reasons why I'm troubled by, I believe these were sincere people making sincere measurements, but I think there's a number of unknown variables here, because my understanding of physics is having trouble accepting the face value of what's stated. K2KEY with some delay, K2RIW.
This is the quandary, this is the question mark I have. The big question mark like they have. No, the transmitters, everything was the same basically. Transmitters were working at the same power, 100 watts. They were good piece of equipment. They were ICOM Pro rigs and everything. Now, there's no problem there that the transmitters weren't performing up to 100% performance. No power change or anything like that took place. It's just something else. Is it terrain? That kind of terrain they were. Well, they didn't change anything in the way of radials or any of that kind of stuff. It was just Mother Nature doing a job, and they were surprised themselves. They didn't know exactly what happened at the expedition, and then until analysis was brought out by it, one of these people that was working with Landsdorfer by the name, I think his name is Sasha. He was one of the people also involved in the development with Landsdorfer. I believe it was done in Germany. The original Landsdorfer is a German, was German person doing the work there. And he says, no, it didn't surprise him at all that the improvement in the signal. This goes on and says, gee, it almost sounds like we should go home and stop bending up our verticals into a new shape. And I didn't quite understand putting two to two together how this accomplished without, like you say, more real estate. But this is where I get, well, someday get some more clarification, Dick, as more experiments are done on this antenna system. And I have some ideas what to do over.
Yeah, I can think of a number of experiments we can try to try to resolve this. Is there any possibility, Mel, that the antenna got bent up by a storm? The storm itself was so severe that it made significant change in the propagation characteristics for the next couple of days. Yes, the antenna got bent up. Is there a slim possibility that was a red herring? And the real change was the propagation, because Mother Nature felt like changing it, or because the storm induced a change in the propagation? What's your guess as to the possibility of that one, Mel? Go ahead. And by the way, we're getting down to 3 or 4 minutes. We're getting down to the bewitching hour here. K2KEY, K2LIW.
According to the article, propagation measurements and all remained the same. Everything was the gray line and everything. Not that didn't shift that drastically in that short period of time. And it was consistent over days after that. So they ruled that all out. That was just a head scratcher for them also, that that it was so consistently better with reports, I could say, from all four points, all corners of the world, literally. All right. But what I'd like to do, I'm gonna, when I get a chance, gonna do some sketch work. I'd like to make a dipole, simple dipole, up for 2 meters, let's say, here, and add additional material to get a bell shape like that, and make it three wavelengths, maybe, or work on. I want to get some more information technically. What exactly, if there is a scientific way to go about really bending this thing correctly. Maybe just make up a wire and all, and put a standard dipole also for comparison, and then we can get on here and listen to me on simplex and all, and we can evaluate, are we getting any improvement on a simple dipole by going into a Landsdorfer type of design, Dick. It'd be very interesting just to do that simple experiment, because I'd like to see for myself, actually, you know, this modeling and all this stuff is real great, but I guess I'm like you from the old school, like to try to model an antenna in actuality, over.
Yeah, that's the next thing that's bothering me a little bit, Mel. These guys and everyone they talked to saw a significant improvement. That de-expedition was a significant number of years ago. Has anyone rerun any experiments like that since? Why haven't we heard those results? So, maybe it's a bit of a mystery for them, too. You guys were listening to TechNet number 1268 of the series that began in September of 1982. 27 years ago. That's a lot of moons ago. 27 times 12 moons ago. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Try to help the people in Bayville, Long Island, understand that radio is their friend. It's not their enemy. It will help them save their lives. They've got to stop thinking that radio is bad. And bye-bye, you all. Back to you, Mel, for tying the ribbons. K2LIW.
Like I say, we'll have to look more into Landsdorfer. I never heard of this gentleman until this information came before me about fractal antennas, and also in mentioning it, there was this article on 3Y0P, DX Expedition, and when Landsdorfer, Sasha, or whoever worked with him, made this comment. And where it went, that now this DX Expedition, as you said, was back in the 90s. Where it's been since then, and now all of a sudden we see some serious work being done. Enough to be in the IEEE bulletin, which, I mean, you know, this is not, in the IEEE bulletins, I've always relied on their reviews as being fairly technically sound. So, where it's been all this time, now we see some serious work being done on
next,
so,
tonight at 8.
I think we're
going to
have more of it in the future. 73 is organized. This is K2KEY. Have a great week. And I forgot to send my condolences to Rich, if you're still listening, on the passing of his father. I hope all is well with you, Rich, from here on. Take care, Dick.
Bye-bye, Mel. Good night, Chet.
K2RAW, W-H-O-R-A-Y. It was an interesting story this past week about how a cell phone helped save a man's life. Did you hear about that one in New Jersey?
No, give us a couple of words.
Okay, basically what happened is, I don't recall exactly where New Jersey was. It was out in the woods somewhere. It must have been a good couple miles away from New York. But this guy was walking out in the woods, and he decided to take a shortcut of what appeared to be a creek, a dried-up creek. Ended up being a mud bog. So this guy starts walking across. He's a fairly elderly guy, and he gets stuck up to his waist.
And it's a good thing the guy had his cell phone and he's able to call for help and grab a, you know, tree branch that was hanging out at about 20 feet from the shore with this